All right, so this first photo right here is a picture of Constantine, and this is when he's talking about the burning cross, right? So he found this is supposedly the moment that Constantine founded Christianity or realized he wanted to make the Roman Empire its main religion, Christianity. So this represents the scene. He's on the battlefield. He sees the burning cross in the sky. Thinking that it's God speaking to him. And, it could be a true story. It could just be a fabricated tale that he used to push onto the people. But who knows? Who knows? So, yeah. All right. So, yeah, in part two, I talked about the first, like, literally from the moment Jesus died in 30 AD to 300 AD. I went over how the apostles got persecuted, all 12 apostles, all 70 disciples got persecuted, except for one. I talked about in part two how each, like, which Roman emperor was the worst persecutor of Christians, and who, how many Christians they, the ones that persecuted them, killed. And I ended part two on the Emperor Diocletian, and I'll talk about him later, where he instilled the Great Persecution, which is the main one that everyone, as Christians, know, like when they think about, persecutions, that's the one that gets brought up. And so, yeah, I just found it interesting that the Roman emperor that did the worst actions towards Christians, the one right after him, is when they actually convert the whole pagan empire into Christianity. And it just by that thought process kind of should have you scratching your heads like, okay, how did they go from the worst emperor to the most holy emperor, overnight? And the most logical explanation is, well, they came up with a different plan. It didn't go from the most evil man to the most holy emperor, like the most evil emperor to the most holy emperor. It was a shift in strategy. Okay? A shift in strategy. That's all. And I'll explain it to you how, why. Okay? So, early Christianity was it, the early Christianity blossomed because of the persecutions. And it was because Christians met in houses, each other's houses. In Acts chapter 1:13, they actually say that the churches of Asia greet you, especially Aquila and Prisca, greet you much in the Lord, along with the church that is in their house. So he's talking about in their house, 1 Corinthians 16:19. This is how the people met for church for the first 270 years of Christianity. They met in each other's houses and spread the Bible, read the Bible. There was no organized church. And the population of Christians went from 6,000 to 6 million in 200 years. So, and 6 million is 10% of the entire Roman Empire. That's how large it got that quickly. All right. So I wanted to start out by explaining modern day Roman Catholic Church. Modern day the Romans, what they represent. And they're obsessed with Saint Peter, okay, which is one of Jesus's 12 apostles. There's nothing wrong with Saint Peter. He's very holy. But what the Roman Catholic Church did is they're latching on to St. Peter, calling him the first pope, and they're very, I think it's because they're super focused because St. Peter died. He was he was put on the cross just like Jesus was, but he got put on an upside down cross when he was crucified. He was on an upside down cross, so that's why the St. Peter's cross is the upside down cross, which we know today as an evil symbol. Okay? Like, in evil films in Hollywood, and, you know, it's the representation of the Antichrist, when you think about it. And the Roman Catholic Church is just so happens to be obsessed with St. Peter, and his cross is represented by the upside-down cross. I found that very interesting. The symbolism doesn't stop there, because the St. Peter's Basilica, which is the main... That's the headquarters of the Vatican in Italy, in Rome. And the St. Peter's Square, which is right next to it, which is this right here. This is the blueprint of St. Peter's Square and St. Peter's Basilica, which is the church. I went over this in the Antediluvian Obsession series. This is actually the Star of Ishtar. We have a cross with an X. That's the Star of Ishtar at the St. Peter's Square. And then the blueprint for the St. Peter's Basilica is actually a cross. But since it's called St. Peter's Basilica, that is, in my head, thinking, okay, so they're representing this as the upside-down cross. Because it's called St. Peter's Basilica. And yeah, for those of you that think, oh, I'm just, you know, making stuff up, I just flipped the photo. No, I mean, the upside-down cross is important to the Roman Catholic Church, because you can just look here. They have it on the back of their pope chairs, or used to. This is one of the popes, I think Pope John Paul. And yeah, so upside-down cross is important to the Roman Catholic Church. And a lot of people, this is thinking, in a lot of people's heads, they're thinking this is a holy symbol. I just don't think so. I don't think so. I think this represents evil. So, alright, so let's get back into history. So Constantine became the emperor in 306 AD, ruled for 31 years, and this is when Christianity became the official religion of the Roman Empire. So when you first look at this photo, who do you think it is? Kind of looks like Jesus, right? But in reality, it is not. It is Constantine. So this is part of... This was Constantine's plan. So because the Roman emperors wanted people to see them as gods, right? That's what pagan Rome did with the sun god. The Roman emperor said, treat me as a god. I am a god. The Roman emperor is the god of the Roman Empire, the Roman Empire. So this is how they got people to do works for them, because the people actually thought they were like representatives of the sun god. But since Christianity came in, and in 200 years it just blew up, 10% of the population are Christians now, and they have a massive army. You know, the Roman Empire has a massive army. And of course they would have Christians, probably a lot of the people that were in the army, the lower leveled army, in the lower levels, they were Christians. And they probably noticed that they were no longer worshiping the emperor as a god. They were worshiping the Christian god. And that single fact alone would cause the emperors to panic. So this was their grand plan after Diocletian. Remember, Diocletian was the one that did the great persecution of Christians. So Constantine needed to become a godlike figure to the Christians, and he had to do it somehow. So what better way than turning him into a Jesus-like figure? So you can see here, Constantine kind of looks like Jesus. You know, they got the halo around him. They got, you know, little beard here, kind of long hair. Jesus, looks like Jesus with the cross. Yeah, that's what they did. That's what Constantine wanted to happen. But at the same time, he needed to figure out a way to make the pagans happy. So when the pagans look at this, they just see a massive sun behind his head. And he kind of looks like Helios or Apollo, as you'll see. Speaking of that, Apollo, the sun god Apollo, sun god Mithras, Helios, Constantine, and Jesus all look very similar. Okay, if you look at pictures of them. Here's a picture of Helios, or the sun god, the Roman sun god right here. You can see they got the sun behind his head with rays coming out. And the sun god is always riding a chariot with four horses. Keep that in mind. Keep that in mind. And then, So, and here's another picture right here. We got the Roman sun god looking very similar to Constantine. Let's go back to the picture of Constantine. And you can see here that picture kind of looks very similar to Constantine, right? It's that big circle behind the head. What is that? That's the sun. So when you look at pictures of Jesus, right? Paintings of Jesus, pictures of him, he has like a massive burst, like a sunburst coming out from behind him. Well, to the pagans, that's the sun, okay? So that's why Rome started doing all these paintings and pictures all over, saying this is Jesus. This is Jesus. But to pagans, to the secret elite, they're okay with spreading these images because to them, this is Helios, this is Apollo, Mithras, this is the Roman emperor. Because to them, they speak through symbolism. And if they have that big giant sun behind the head, that's all that matters. Oh, there we go. There's the sun god right there. Because it's all about the symbolism. That's all. And here's another picture of Jesus right here. We got a nice little sunburst behind him. Sun rays coming out of this one. That's done on purpose. So the elite are okay with those images. They look at that, they're like, there's the sun god Helios. But yeah, I mean, if you're a Christian looking at these photos, you say that's Jesus, that's fine. That's fine too. You can be, the images, you could look at that image and say praise Jesus and be totally fine with that statement. But I'm just making it aware to people of what these other people believe in. They look at those images and see the sun god. And I'm just trying to show you this is what the Roman Empire did. This is what Constantine did. He used symbolism to please both sides. And it couldn't be more apparent than this mosaic that they created in 450 AD, which is 100 years after Constantine. It's actually, you can still see it today in Ravenna, Italy, in a chapel that has been existed for that long. There's a mosaic of Jesus wearing a Roman emperor like clothes with the sun behind him, nice little sun cross behind him. And yeah, they say this is Jesus. They say that's Jesus depicted as the Roman emperor. So you can see how they're merging these ideas together to make everybody happy. And this is very similar to the idea of universalism, which is a Masonic idea of merging all the religions together. The Masons want to make everyone happy. Even the Roman Catholic Church wants to do that. They're doing it through peace, right? Through peace, they will merge all the religions, universalism. Constantine's Rome, right? Constantine wanted Jesus to mirror Rome's image and his image rather than Rome mirroring the image of Jesus. That's all that mattered to them. As long as they got Jesus to imitate them, they'd be okay. So Jesus became this, like, this sun god to them. And that's what made it okay for them to spread the images everywhere. I don't know if people know this, but Constantine ended up extending many benefits to pagan priests who became Christian ministers. So see how it was like infiltration right off the bat. It was infiltration. He was giving them monetary support. And he said you wouldn't be able to pay taxes. He wanted pagans to become priests. He wanted these pagans to become priests. He wasn't asking Christians, right? You would think he would extend many benefits to Christians to become Christian ministers. But no, he extended benefits to pagan priests to become Christian ministers. Do you see that? Do you see that? Yeah. Infiltration. That's what they did. They wanted to infiltrate it and kind of get the ideas, to flip the ideas on the head, on their head. Speaking of Diocletian, so we'll kind of rewind back time. So Diocletian was the one that actually killed Christians. He was part of the Great Persecution. And while this was happening in North Africa was part of the Roman Empire, Christians who were caught actually had a choice in North Africa. They had a more lenient officer, Roman officer. And he said, if you guys turn your Bibles in to authorities, then you won't be killed. And what these people were labeled, these Christians were labeled, they were called traditores. Traditores. Which stands for, in Latin, traditores in Latin, in English, means those who handed the holy thing over. And this is actually where the word traitor comes from, which I found interesting. And the Christians that were in North Africa, they were called the Donatists, D-O-N-A-T-I-S-T. And so when Constantine was emperor, these traditores, the traitors who turned in their Bibles to not die, you know, they wanted to become priests, right? They said, okay, well, since Christianity is now legalized, we want to become priests. But the Donatists called them out. They said, you guys are traitors. You guys turned your back on us. They're saying, like, everyone that didn't turn in their Bibles, that held it to their heart, they all died. But you're saying because, you know, you turned your Bible in to the authorities so you didn't die, but now that Constantine comes in and says, oh, the religion, now you're saying you want to become a Christian priest? And so they were upset. They were upset to the point where Constantine got involved. They were saying no to traditores. And Constantine came in and was like, I want these people to become priests, because most likely these traditores, these traitors, became pagans or pagan priests. And these were the pagan priests that were getting the benefits of Constantine's rules. But these Donatists were turning them away, saying, we don't want these people to become priests. Sure, you guys can become Christians, part of the church. You know, it's all about forgiveness, but we don't want them to become leaders in our area. But Constantine forced these traitors to become priests. And he did it by burning the churches and martyr. Like, he was doing prosecutions himself in this North African area from 317 to 321. And this was after he supposedly said he was Christian, right? Supposedly, you know, after he actually made the Roman Empire Christian, he's still going around killing these Christians that are standing up for themselves. So you can see he's, right, he's got his own little idea of Christianity he's pushing. He doesn't want these pure Christians standing up. He's all about, he wants authority and power to take over Christianity. So yeah, let's dive deep into Constantine's actual belief system. So if you look into it, Constantine was devoted to Mithraism, or the cult of Mithras. And if you do research into Mithras, you'll see that the worshippers of Mithras had a complex system of 7 grades of initiation and communal ritual meals. And initiates, they called themselves initiates, united by the handshake. Oh, that sounds pretty interesting, doesn't it? Very similar to Freemasons. So you can see why the Freemasons are obsessed with Mithras. But the thing about Mithraism was it's pretty much sun worship. And it was like the underground idea of sun worship. So, yes, the Roman Empire worshipped the sun. But behind the scenes, it was represented by Mithra. And Mithra had to do with sacrificing a bull and wearing a hat. But he was pretty much a sun god, like the underground sun god to the Roman Empire. Like Sol Invictus and Apollo, they were like the outer, what they showed to like the public. But the secret, you know, what the elites worshipped was Mithra, and like they sacrificing bulls, wearing these hats. So this is what the secret cult worshipped underground. So yeah, it involved sacrificing a bull during their ceremonies. If you guys remember, I talked about Justin Martyr in part 2. He was one of the people that got persecuted in 145 AD. And he actually talked about the cult of Mithras, and he actually charged them, or said that they were imitating Christianity. And this was back in 145 AD, which was, you know, almost 200 years earlier than Constantine. They're already imitating Christianity. So you can see, like, this cult was coming in. They saw Christianity, and they were already infiltrating it. They were already trying to imitate it. They were known to wear these caps called Phrygian caps, I think they're called. Mithraic caps. Sacrificial caps. So it's known as the red cap of liberty. It symbolizes the sacred acts of initiation, sacrifice, liberty, revolution, enlightenment, and brotherhood. These red caps. And they're pretty ancient. Like, you could, they go back in time. You could trace them back to Baal, actually. The false god Baal of Canaan, Phoenicians. Baal, yeah, the child sacrificing god. And the first statue of Baal. Like, if you go look up Baal at Wikipedia, and you go back in time, like, what statue did they, like, the earliest statue of Baal. He's wearing a Phrygian cap, the same cap that Mithras is wearing. And Baal, as you know, is associated with a bull because of Moloch, which is putting a child into a bull-like furnace, right? And it just so happens Mithras is sacrificing a bull. So you can see how it's all connected, right? It's the same cult, this old cult that started in Babylon, worked its way to Egypt, and then into Phoenicians. I talked about this in the origins of the Cabal. And the antediluvian obsession, go over that too. Horus in Egypt actually is also wearing the same cap as Baal. If you look at pictures of Horus, he's got this weird hat thing. It's like almost exactly the same hat as Ball's wearing. I never noticed that until this thread. It's like a pointy hat with a ball on top. It's kind of like, all right. Mithras has got the same little hat. The guy, and in modern day, this is what the revolutionaries were using. So in the American Revolution, the French Revolution, the caps start popping up everywhere, like in the late 1700s. 1776, 1800s, you start seeing this Mithras cap popping up everywhere again. You're like, what is happening? Ganymede is where is wearing the cap with Zeus next to him, but Zeus is transformed into an eagle. We all in the origins of the Cabal, I connected Zeus to Baal as well because he was a lightning god. Baal is known as the lightning god. Marduk, lightning god. Seal of the U.S. Army, which was created in 1775, also is represented by a Mithra cap. Very weird that the Mithra cap is like right in the middle there. It's a symbol of the French Revolution. So during the French Revolution, a lot of people wore the Mithra cap. Just recently during like a French revolutionary kind of thing, in modern day, a lot of people were wearing a Mithra cap. And this is very interesting too. So the Apotheosis of Washington fresco, which I brought up in the my Origins of the Knights Templar, this fresco is right underneath the Senate Dome, which is like the most powerful building in the world, the Senate building in the United States in Washington, D.C., we have, right, remember I talked about that in the Antediluvian Obsession Origins of the Knights Templar, we have Ishtar. Ishtar is at the top of the dome, right? And then we have that dome sun symbolism. Remember, the dome represents sun symbolism. Underneath the dome is a fresco of George Washington right there. But next to George Washington is this lady wearing this Phrygian cap. The Mithra cap, the red Mithra cap of liberty. Another interesting thing, right? Makes you think of the United States, like, what is its actual purpose, right? Is it? It's not a Christian nation. I keep telling that to everyone. It's not a Christian nation. Get that through your head. All right. So we have... So now we go back to the Roman times. So this cult of Mithras during the Roman times was specifically for highly elitist and exclusive people. It's closed its way to the masses and was particularly popular with legionnaires. The legionnaires, which was like high-ranking Roman soldiers. So we find traces of the cult of Mithras everywhere legions were stationed. Shores of the Black Sea to Britain to Sahara Desert. And the legions just so happened to be connected with eagle symbolism. The eagle. When you look up Roman legionnaires, it's an eagle. They were eagles. So yeah, yeah, crazy. Here's a little depiction of the Mithras. We have children wearing Mithras. We got Mithraic right here. I mean, it was all over Rome at the time. So the eagle, which is known as Aquila in Roman, was a prominent symbol for the legionnaires. A legionary was known as Aquilifer, which is known as the eagle bearer. So you can tell the legions were connected to the eagles. Here's a bunch of legions. They had an eagle there. The Ark of Constantine is littered with eagles. There's one right here. But no Christian symbols, no crosses. The Ark of Constantine was created after he said that, you know, the Roman Catholic Church or Christianity was legalized within the empire. Yep, there's Ganymede again with the eagle. Ganymede is also identified with Aquarius. Aquarius is known as Gula, the Great One, in the Babylonian star catalogs and represents the god Ea himself, who is commonly depicted holding an overflowing face. So you can see how it's connected to Babylon, right? The Babylon character with an eagle. And if you guys do any research into like the New World Order, what they believe in, or the New Age, really like this New Age stuff that's popping up, the Age of Aquarius is massive. I guess we're just entering into this Age of Aquarius, which represents the dawning of the New World Order. So interesting that all this is coming up. All right, so now let's talk about Constantine's like obsession with the sun god. Like he made Christianity legalized, but if you look any like just under the cover, just take a peek into Constantine's personal life and you'll see this man was obsessed with his sun god even after he supposedly said he became Christian, which means he's lying to the public. That's all it means. So if you look at his coinage, right? When he was emperor, if you look at his official coinage, it included images of Sol Invictus, Apollo, until 325-326. The coin depicted Sol Invictus with the legend Soli Invicto Comiti, which means unconquered sun in Latin. And there's a picture of the coin right there. Also, Constantine decreed on March 7th, 321 AD, the day of Dies Solis, which is called the Day of the Sun. And now, which is referred as today as Sunday. And this is what he said. On the venerable day of the sun, let the magistrates and people residing in cities rest. Let all the workshops be closed. In the country, however, persons engaged in agriculture may freely and lawfully continue their pursuits, because it often happens that another day is not suitable for grain sowing or vine planting, lest by neglecting the proper moment for such operations, the bounty of heaven should be lost. So he's not talking about Jesus. He's not talking about, I don't see anything about Christianity in here. All I see is he says, literally in the first sentence, on the venerable day of the sun. He's talking about the sun. He doesn't care about Christianity or Jesus. He's telling people, rest on the day of the sun. My favorite Lord, the Sun Lord. In 330 AD, Constantine set up a statue, which is just proves this guy's obsessed with the sun god. And this is supposedly after decades of supporting Christianity. He appeared as a statue of the sun god in the Forum. And this pillar is actually still, you can see this pillar in Istanbul, city of Istanbul in Turkey today. But it doesn't have his statue on top of it anymore. It's just the pillar. But when he created the pillar, it literally was Constantine. The figure at the top was Constantine with seven spikes on his head, representing the sun god, Helios. He looks like a replica of the Statue of Liberty, which I already explained is Helios. It's a sun god representation. Anytime you see the spikes coming out of the head, it's a representation of the sun god. So, yeah. And that's him. He's replacing himself with the God, right? Very similar to what he wanted with Christianity. He wanted people to think that he was the Lord on earth, the Christian Lord on earth, which is what Pope, that's what the Pope wants you to think. Like, look up the description of the Pope. It's like, he is the representative of Jesus on earth. And that's what Constantine was doing. And that, you know, 300 AD. So yeah, this is what it looked like back in time. Right in the center of the square, like, super important location. All right, so now let's talk about the Ark of Constantine. And, yeah. So he built this ark in 312 AD, which was after he said he was Christian. I already mentioned the ark already, where I described how there's a bunch of eagles on it, but there's no Christian symbols on it. But this is what the ark looks like in Rome. It's still standing today. It's an amazing structure. I mean, it, like, when you see it in person, it's just like, what the heck? It's huge. All sorts of art is covering it. But if you look up close, it is a pagan symbol. I mean, I already talked about the triptych, right? In one of my old threads, the ancient religion of Freemasonry, the triptych is very important. Triptych is a larger center doorway with two on the side. The triptych is very symbolic to them. So that's a start. And then these four statues at the top, just wait until I describe to you what these four statues at the top represent. I talk about them soon. He has a message up here, which I will also talk about. And on the side of it, one of these circles is on the side, on one of the sides. And I'll show you what a picture of that represents. But it's very symbolic, as you'll see, of the sun, the unconquered sun. Statuettes of Sol Invictus, the Roman sun god, appear in three places on the Ark of Constantine. So here's one of them right here. It's very pronounced on the side. So remember there's one on the side. It has just one massive piece of the sun god. You can see the four horses. You can see the sun god riding the horses. Apollo or Mithras, could be either one. And as you can see what I just showed you, the ark does not have a statue at the top. Right, but when he created it, it did have a statue. It had a bronze statue, and it was of Constantine riding four horses, a chariot of four horses. And what did I say? Remember what I said? That is exactly what the Roman sun god does. He rides a chariot of four horses. That's the sun god's symbol. So, yeah. At the very top of the ark, it reads Instinctive Divinitatis, which means divinely inspired. So, he was divinely inspired by the sun god. There is no symbols, Christian symbols, on this ark. So, he was divinely inspired by the sun god, not by Christian god. And just to, like, I mean, this is, why would he place that ark there, right? Right next to the Colosseum. He placed it in a weird spot next to the Colosseum. But you have to remember, back in Rome, back in ancient Rome at the time, there was a massive, colossal statue of Sol Invictus. It was a massive statue. And it was also right next to the Colosseum. And that is where he placed the ark. He placed the ark right there. The main road of Rome used to run right through that main archway, the main road of Rome. So you would come enter the city, go through Constantine's Arch. As you're going through the arch, you would see this massive this massive statue, Sol Invictus, entering the city. Colosseum is on your right. You'd see the statue of Constantine at the top with the statues of him riding horses. All just telling you, worship the sun god. Welcome to Rome. So he placed it there on purpose. It was him saying, yes, I worship the sun god, pretty much. Dedication to the sun god. Remember what I told you? Remember the four figures at the top? The four figures at the top of the Constantine, right here. 1, 2, 3, 4. There's actually four more on the other side. Well, here they are zoomed in. Okay, there's eight figures at the top of the Arch of Constantine, and here they are zoomed in. Look what they're wearing, guys. A good old little Phrygian cap. Mithra cap. The cap of Mithra. The sun god. The god that is associated with sacrificing a bull. Spilling its blood. And yeah, so that should just, you know, there we go. Let's get the dust off my shoulders there. I just proved Constantine worships the sun, okay? And this was after he announced he was, you know, push Christianity onto the people. Here's a mosaic that was created in 565 AD of the three magi of Jesus Christ wearing Mithra caps. So you can see here how Rome is infiltrating and trying to dirty up the story of Jesus, right? Dirty up the New Testament of the Magi being part of this Mithraic cult, right? They're the Magi coming in, celebrating Jesus' birth, giving him gifts, and they just so happen to put this Mithraic cap on all three of the Magi. This mosaic that was created in 565 AD. And it's called the Three Magi, and it's in the Basilica of Sant Apollinare Nuovo in Italy. So it's been there a long time. But this is what people associate the Magi as wearing, these Mithraic caps. But you got to remember, this is Rome trying to add their symbolism to the New Testament and to Jesus. You have to remember this. This is them trying to infiltrate and add symbolism. So, all right. So, yeah, let's talk about Christmas then. The three Magi and, you know, the giving gifts to Jesus, you know, Christmas. So this all has to do with Christmas, right? I mean, even their hats look like Santa's hat. Well, that was done on purpose, okay? Santa looks like the way he does on purpose. All right. So back in time, let's rewind back in time. And during these pagan days, before Jesus, during the pagan times, okay, there were festivals. And they were all, these festivals have been celebrated and been going on throughout time. Before Jesus, they were celebrating these winter solstice and spring equinox holidays, pagan holidays. And they've been celebrating these for a long time. And the first time that the Romans actually incorporate the birth of Jesus in their calendar was in 354 AD, right around the time of Constantine, just right after Constantine was emperor, in the Philo-Calician calendar. But in that same calendar, there's also a festival called the Invicti CMXX. In English, that's called Birthday of the Unconquered Games Ordered 30 Races. Remember, Unconquered Sun. Okay, that's what they called the sun, the unconquered sun. And it was celebrated on December 25th. Okay? This festival was going on even before that, but this calendar was the first calendar that mentioned this festival, which was a pagan feast of Sol Invictus. But it also mentioned the birthday of Jesus at the same time, as you'll see. So the winter solstice holiday on December 5th is dedicated to King Helios, Sol Invictus. It is a feast day observed as the point when the sun renews itself. The cold winter is defeated, and the sun is reborn once again. Emperor Julian links the celebration as something based on the practice of Numa Pompilius. December, it just represents when the days start getting longer. Like, the shortest day is behind, and now we're getting longer days throughout the year. So the same calendar that came out, right, that came out in 354 AD, was the same calendar that the first time that Lord Jesus Christ's birth date was mentioned. Now, come on. you have to see through it, right? This person that's making this calendar for Rome, charge of Rome, is, and this is right after Constantine's master plan of merging Christianity with pagan ideas, just so happens to put that December 25th day to the birth of Lord Jesus Christ, right? December 25th. Even though the Bible never mentions what day Jesus was born, never mentions it, the apostles never mentioned what day he was born, right? It just so happens to come from a Roman calendar. Right around the time the Romans are merging Christianity with their pagan religion. Right? I mean, come on. You have to just think outside. Not outside the box. Just look at their point of view. That's what I notice, like, the biggest issue with humanity these days, or just with people in general, is they have a very hard time of looking at perspectives that aren't their own. I'm able to put myself in, that's why I'm doing what I'm doing, because it's very easy for me to put myself in other people's shoes, and it doesn't affect me at all. I'm putting myself in the shoes of a pagan Roman emperor. Or a pagan calendar maker, right? That's trying to get Christianity mixed into their pagan holidays. And this is exactly what they would do. Put December 25th, match it with Lord Jesus Christ and their Sol Invictus. Right? it's simple when you think of it in that perspective. It's simple. These festivals weren't just one day, okay? This was, like, the Sol Invictus Day was a special day. But prior to this day, they had a long festival that included how many days? Okay, yeah, I'll talk about that soon. The festival was Saturnalia. Which was a festival from December 17th to December 23rd. So about the week before Christmas, or before Sol Invictus Day for the Roman Emperor. They had Saturnalia, and then they had Sol Invictus. So Saturnalia represented the festival celebration, and yeah. And here's a coin right here of Saturn driving a four-horse chariot called Quadriga on a reverse of a denarius issued in 104 BC coin. So you can see here, this is before Jesus was born. And this is Saturn now riding four horses. You can see how Saturn's kind of connected with the sun god as well. We got four horses, we got Saturn, we got the coin. It looks like he's wearing some kind of crown there. So yeah. And modern day Santa Claus, what is modern day Santa Claus doing? He's on a chariot floating in the sky with reindeer. Okay? That's not a coincidence. The sun god roams the sky with his four horses and a chariot. We got Santa Claus, and Santa Claus is wearing a cap, a red cap. It looks exactly like the Phrygian cap that the sun god wears, Mithras, right? He's got a red cap, and he's floating in the sky, giving gifts away. You know, that's what the sun god's doing. So that's what they're doing. That's how they trick modern day society, or that's how they've been tricking us. They get that imagery, that symbolism, because to them that represents the sun god. Santa Claus is the sun god. That's why they push that imagery in the commercials all over the place, because that's the sun god to them. They don't care. They don't care. It's on, you know, they know this date was made for the sun god and has been for a long time. They know this date was important to them before Jesus. So in order to keep tricking Christians, they have to associate it with Christianity. And they're okay with that. As long as they have their symbolism, they're happy. So yeah, December 17th, December 23rd was Saturnalia. So Saturnalia was celebrated with a sacrifice at the Temple of Saturn in the Roman Forum and a public banquet following by private gift giving, continual partying, and a carnival-like atmosphere that overturned Roman social norms. Sounds pretty similar to what happens at Christmas, right? We have different music during Christmas. Like the whole the period seems different. Everyone's jolly, merry, very merry. Gift giving, private gift giving. That's all from this ancient pagan winter solstice holiday. All right. So now, I mean, Christmas isn't the only one. What's more important than Christmas to Christians? Easter. Okay? Well, guess what happened around the same time of year in Rome? The spring equinox, which was dedicated to Cybele, the mother of all Roman gods. So this is, remember, in the antediluvian obsession, we got the Freemasons believe in the Divine Mother, Divine Father, and the Divine Son, right? The Trinity to them. Well, you know, during Christmas, we're celebrating the Divine Father, I think. Like a mixture of the Father and the Son, I think. To them, the Divine Father and the Divine Son, I think it's a mixture of both. And then in Easter, we're celebrating the Divine Mother. So there we go. We got all of their special gods being worshipped around these time periods, the spring equinox. So it was called... So we have two festivals very similar to Christmas, where they have Saturnalia, and then they have the actual day celebration, Sol Invictus Day. So it's very similar to Easter. But it's way longer. Like this one in the spring is way more important to them, because we got this one's lasting from March 15th to March 25th, 10 days. It's called the Hilaria. It's called the Cheerful Ones. And it's all about this Cybele Divine Mother. And she's represented by two lions. Okay. She's also known as the Magna Mater. So this is where Gaia. So Gaia from Greek, the Greek culture. Gaia, okay. Now is Cybele in Roman culture. And if you guys remember my origins of the Cabal and the other ones I've been talking about, I talk about Ishtar, right? Talk about Semiramis. So Babylon is where this Trinity started. And then Ishtar was where it originated from. And then it go to Astarte, Isis in Egypt. But this Cybele, okay, one sec. But it's weird, in the Greek culture, in the Odyssey, it kind of split up this Trinity. Because I noticed Greek culture also has Aphrodite, and Gaia. It has a bunch of different, like, Libertas, or I think that's Rome. It has a bunch of different women goddesses that originally represented the one original divine mother. Greece kind of split that up. So that's why it's kind of hard to find different, like, where it, but I think it's represented by different goddesses and goddesses through Greece and Rome. Because they kind of did the same thing with Zeus and the sun god. Because Zeus is like lightning. And then we have Helios is the sun god. But in Phoenicia, it all was, you know, Baal was both. He was the sun and the lightning. So it gets confusing. It kind of splits off in Greece. Like each of the divine mother and father and son, they kind of all split into two. And represented by more false goddesses and gods. So yeah, Gaia was like Cybele. She was the mother of all the goddesses. And she only represented like earth, earthly stuff like Gaia does, you know, like represents all of them. While Aphrodite and Libertas, one represents liberty, one represents sex, you know. You know, Ishtar represented all of those. She was the divine mother. She was sex, liberty. She represented all of it. But in Greece and Rome, you know, these characteristics got split into different goddesses and gods. So that's why it's kind of confusing when you get to Greece and Rome. You got all sorts of goddesses and goddesses, but Cybele, I just learned about Cybele through this researching this thread. I had no idea how important she was to Rome. Same with Mithras. But yeah, so let's get back to it. So yeah, March, it was 10 days. And the March equinox, this happened during the March equinox. So yeah. And this is the full festival right here. The reed entered Attis, I think, was her son, maybe. I don't know who Ad was, but you can see here, like, it kind of reminds you of Lent. Look at this. A 9-day period abstinence from bread, pomegranates, quinces, pork, fish, wine. Only milk was permitted. So very, very similar to Lent. The pre... What the Roman Catholics do, right? Prior to Easter. And then March 22nd, the tree entered. A pine tree is felled. The tree is set up at the Temple of Cybele. Trunk is wrapped in wool and his branches decked with wreaths of violets. A day of mourning. The day of blood. Okay. The day of joy, celebrating the resurrection of Attis, a day of rest, the washing, possible ceremony at the Vatican Sanctuary. I found that interesting. They called it the Vatican Sanctuary. Like, I tried doing research, like, what is the Vatican Sanctuary in Rome? Is that where the Vatican came up with the name Vatican? Like, I did a little bit of digging. I couldn't find anything, so I think I might dig into that more. Appears in the calendar of Philocalus. All right, so that was the first festival. And then we have the main one, the Megalesia, from April 4th to April 10th, which is kind of around the time Easter happens. It's another dedication to Cybele. And you can see here, here's some weird symbolism with her. This is the first time I actually see that. Like, is that a pineapple? Pine cone? The pine cone symbolism, maybe that's what it represents. We got two lions there. She has very interesting symbolism around her. So she was the mistress of wild nature, a healer, goddess of fertility. That's very important, fertility. Protectress in time of war. Right? All right, so now, okay, so this is what Rome celebrated. Right? Prior to the Roman Catholic Church creating Christmas and Easter. This is what Rome celebrated, which is very similar to Easter and Christmas. But Rome actually got this from a precursor civilization, which was Greece. And then Greece got that from a precursor civilization, which was Phoenicia, Baal, and Astarte. And they got that from Babylon. All right, I was able to trace it all the way back to Babylon. And it all has to circle back around this calendar of Babylon. So, if you guys don't know, Easter's date is always changing every year. Don't you find that weird? Don't you want to know why that happens? I mean, seriously, that's all you got. In order to figure out stuff in present day, you just have to ask why until you can't really until you don't know the answer anymore, you know. That's what I do. But Easter falls on the Paschal full moon. And it is the it's pretty much a full moon of the northern spring, and is used in the determination of the date of Easter. So it's the equinox. So the spring equinox happens, and it's the first, whatever that is, full moon after the spring equinox. How does that have anything to do with Jesus? Can someone explain that to me? I mean, right there, how does that have anything to do with Jesus? Is that mentioned anywhere in the Bible? Does it mention anything about a spring equinox and full moon? Does it mention that anywhere in the New Testament? I don't think so. So yeah, that's what I say here. Notice the similarities with the moon and spring. Look at this. You guys ready for this? The Babylonian calendar began with the first new moon after the March equinox. Sounds like Easter's kind of closer to this than anything in the Bible, right? And guess what this day represents? The day after the return of the Sumerian goddess Inanna, known as, wait for it, Ishtar, baby. It's like I'm over the target all the time. But this is what I'm saying, right? So this is why Rome was celebrating Cybele throughout this time period. Because Cybele is part of this divine mother, Ishtar, Inanna, Babylon. All right, let's finish this sentence. The day after the return of the Sumerian god Inanna, later known as Ishtar, from the underworld. And the ceremony is called the Kitu. And it's actually still celebrated today. Actually, you can look up a Kitu and it's still celebrated in Iraq today. It's probably the oldest ceremony of all time, honestly. So there's parades through the Ishtar Gate. This is what they used to do to the Inanna Temple. And the ritual reenactment of the marriage to Tammuz, or Sumerian Dumuzi. Here's a quote from the book The Pagan Roots of Easter. Today we see a secular culture celebrating the spring equinox, whilst religious culture celebrates the resurrection. However, early Christianity made a pragmatic acceptance of ancient pagan practices, much of which we enjoy today at Easter. The general symbolic story of the death of the sun, isn't that ironic? Sun, and then we have, it's also S-U-N-S-O-N. Interesting how they use that. And his rebirth, overcoming the powers of darkness, was a well-worn story in the ancient world. Yep. So now we see the holiday of Easter really comes from Babylon, spreading out first to the various nations and the empires of the world, such as Egypt, which sprout up their own versions later. From there, it spread to the ends of the earth. First, some may try to say the Passover and Easter are almost the same, yet there are some differences. However, for one, Passover is customarily celebrated on a certain day of the year. Right? And Easter is an ancient spring festival. The date of Easter is not fixed, but instead is governed by the phases of the moon. So Easter is more of a pagan holiday than the Passover that the Jews celebrate. The Jewish people that are in Jerusalem celebrate. So it's pretty pagan. Actually, it is 100% pagan. So, yeah, why connect a Christian holiday on the phases of the moon? You know? That's a method of typical pagan, one who looks to the natural world for signs. You know, possibly some of Christianity had arrived to those of pagan persuasion over time, and Easter had to become an amalgamated holiday, a holiday made to fit in with everybody. Yep, universalism. It's just, that was Roman's way of, that was pagan Rome's way of making everyone that was part of their culture happy. Because there's a lot of Christians, there's a lot of pagans, there's a lot of this old culture involved. So this is their way of just making everyone happy. Also, you know, we have Easter sunrise services on the last day of the moon, right? So we have this full moon. Easter celebrated on the first full moon of this day. The specific day that is different every year. This first full moon that happens. And guess what? The Pope and the Vatican, the Roman Catholic Church, they focus on. They have a sunrise service that focuses on the sun rising on Ishtar's day. And they all face the east. They face the rising sun at the east. Right? So we see no celebration of Easter in the New Testament. Early church fathers celebrated it, and today many churches are offering sunrise services at Easter, an obvious pagan solar celebration. That was from the pagan roots of Easter. Right? These sunrise services seem the main quantifier here is, of course, the sun. Why? What's the importance of having a service at sunrise anyway, or having to face it, if there wasn't at least some connection to the sun here? So we're back to sun worship, constellation worship, the sun and the moon. Like, this is their religion, the sun, moon, all the stars, constellations, this is what they are. So yeah, these customs of Easter honor Baal. He is still worshipped as his rising sun. Baal is pretty much Lucifer, okay? This is what Masons, they call them the Rising Sun. And his house is the house of the Rising Sun. So, yeah, this is mentioned in the Bible, right? This is mentioned in the Bible specifically. In Ezekiel 8:16, their backs towards the temple of the Lord, and their faces towards the east, and they worship the sun towards the east, for they have returned to provoke me to anger. I mean, right there. Facing east towards the sun. And that's what exactly is the Pope doing on Easter? Facing the sun, everyone's worshiping the sun, the rising sun. Sunrise. So yeah. Crazy. Alright, so let's go back to Semiramis. This is the beginning. We got Nimrod, Semiramis, and Tammuz, their original trinity. The pagan trinity of Babylon. This is where it all began. So in Semiramis' story, she claimed that her godliness came from the moon in a giant moon egg that fell into the Euphrates River. In other words, the egg now had become the new symbol of the new ways she laid out for the populace. Her supernatural egg was now considered emblem of generative life and rebirth. It's called the Ishtar egg. And this is why we see eggs on Easter. Also, Ishtar is known as a fertility god, or Cybele, the Roman goddess. She's known as fertility. And guess what animal is symbolized as a fertility animal? Rabbits. Rabbits are seen as symbolizing fertility, but they can also represent new beginnings. This is mainly due to their association with springtime and rebirth, which harks back to many older, far older beliefs. So yeah, just as at the holidays, new names would be inserted for these original gods of Babylon, according to each empire or nation which adopted it. And just like Easter, the winter solstice festival also seemed connected to cycles in nature, such as the changing of the seasons. So as one could guess, it's just another part of this same founding Babylon story of old. Now we're seeing the beginning to see that the birthday of December 25th was at first celebrated as that of the reborn pagan god of Babylon, Nimrod, or Tammuz. As one can guess, this practice must have been spread beyond this early time of Babylon to the rest of the ancient world, and this, of course, includes ancient Rome. Alright, so the Queen Semiramis told the worshippers that when Nimrod, aka Tammuz, was killed, some of his blood fell on the stump of an evergreen tree, and the stump grew into a full new tree overnight. This made the evergreen tree sacred by the blood of Tammuz. That's why Christmas is green and red. That is why it's always been green and red. Okay, we got the evergreen tree, and we have the blood of Tammuz. The blood represents red. That's why it's green and red. And I got that from the pagan origins of Easter, the book. And you can also see this evergreen tree in sculptors of Babylon, like old sculptors of Babylon. I have a picture here. The Christmas tree really comes from an old Babylon fable telling of an evergreen tree which sprang out of a dead tree stump. This obviously symbolized dead Nimrod, and the new evergreen tree symbolized how he had come to life again as the reborn unconquered god Tammuz. So there you go. That's where it comes from. Almost done. So So the evergreen was a pagan symbol of the god born on this day. And since the evergreen tree never seemed to look as though it dies because it stays green all winter, it became the perfect symbol of a martyred god reborn on this day. Now we also have a connection of this holiday to the season of winter, because Nimrod reborn was said to have come out of the underworld, the place of the dead, similar to the dark, death-like surroundings the cold winter gives us. I mean, it's too perfect to even imagine, right? That's why, this is why they use symbols. This is symbolism, guys. This is why they use symbols everywhere. This is why Christmas is the way it is. This is why Easter has all those symbols surrounding it. This is why it is okay in today's culture. Because to them, it's okay. It's representing their gods. Many of the plants used at Christmas are symbols of fertility. Certainly any evergreen, fir, yew, or laurel, with its ability to return verdure in the barren months, is appropriate. It all comes down to pagan origin. Yeah, so does the Bible talk about plants at all? Yes, it does. The Christmas tree, interesting though, may have been among those pagan elements condemned by the Word of God. In Jeremiah, here we go, Jeremiah chapter 10. Thus saith the Lord, learn not the way of the heathen, and be not dismayed at the signs of heaven, for the heathen are dismayed at them. For the customs of the people are vain, for one cutteth a tree out of the forest, the work of the hands of the workmen with the axe. They deck it with silver and with gold. They fasten it with nails and with hammers, that it move not. They are upright as the palm tree. I mean, you can see here, they're talking about Christmas. Like, that's what people do during Christmas. They cut a tree down, decorate it, you know, worshiping the man. All right, so we're at the end. Christmas is a celebration of the winter solstice, and Easter is a celebration of the spring equinox. It is more apparent with Easter because it follows the moon cycle to determine which Sunday Easter will be celebrated on. So, and then I just say the information I found is from this source. But there you go, guys. I mean, I feel like this is a very important thread. You know? It's just, it's not getting the love that I got, like, let's say from the Tim Ballard threads, or, you know, from me focusing on Hawaii. Like, people are so focused on the present day, you know, that, you know, they could care less whether this stuff represents this stuff. But I feel like the stuff I dug up for this is extremely important. More people should care about this, because it's just proving we've all been lied to for so long. And it involves our own religion. Like, if you're a Christian, this should really care. You should care about this.